Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you to the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm excited for our conversation today. We're talking about the most essential resource that powers not only business, but all of life, and that is water. With me in the studio is Ron Fleming, who is President and Chief Executive Officer of Global Water Resources. Welcome, Ron.
Thank you, Adrian. Appreciate it.
And also joining us again is Ben Graff, zoning attorney, a member of the Central Arizona Water Conservation District Board of Directors. That makes you an elected official. It's good to see you again. Last time you were here, we were talking about commercial real estate, and we threw water in at the end. We're going to dive deep, as they say. I can see water metaphors coming here. Welcome back, Ben.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks for having me back.
So, Ron, why don't you start us off by giving us a little context, talking about Global Water Resources, who you are, what you do, how you serve folks.
Sure. Global Water Resources is a private regulated utility company, meaning we own regulated water and wastewater utilities. We actually call ourselves a water resource management company, not a utility, because of the way that we think about the long-term planning and responsibilities of the utility when it comes to water resources and sustainability.
So I live up in Anthem in, you know, the far north outside of city limits, but our mailing address is Phoenix, for lack of a better address. And we get our water from EPCOR. There are people who get their water from you. There are people who get their water from SRP. Kind of, can you give us the landscape of the delivery side of this? Who's out there and how do you fit in the mix?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So you're right. EPCOR is a same type of company, private regulated water utility. They are the largest of those in the state. Global Water is the third largest. From a state level perspective, about 20% of the population are served by private utilities. The rest are served by municipalities, major municipalities, and or districts, depending on where they're located.
Ben, why don't you give us a little overview of yourself and your practice and how water is going to play out in this conversation?
Absolutely. By day, I'm a land use and zoning attorney, and I joke by night, I'm a elected official on the Central Arizona Project Board, although most of our work is done in daylight, so that doesn't quite work. But we, as a board, the Central Arizona Project is a 15-member board, all elected at large within our counties. So I was elected in 2016 as a Maricopa County seat. It is an enormous county. Most people who grow up here don't realize just how large it is. When you're running for office in Maricopa County, it's similar in terms of vote grabs to running for, let's say, governor of Washington or of, you know, other kind of smaller states. So it is, it's an impressive election. A lot of people you have to reach out to.
And you mean geographically in the sense of you have to travel around and—
Both geographically and number of vote counts. So a lot of people are surprised that to get a seat in 2016, you needed to have north of 365,000 votes, people that voted for you to get you in the top five on the board. So it's humbling. By no means, do you not admit that a lot of that is lucky, that maybe somebody had a grandkid named Ben that they liked and they saw you in the ballot. But you hope people are also starting to wise up in Arizona and looking at water issues and realizing that every 2 years when you see the CAP officers on your election ballot, that these are incredibly important down ballot races. And we basically oversee the policy, taxes, all of the issues related to the Colorado River water allocation that comes into Arizona, which is about 40% of Arizona's water intake.
Now, you mentioned last time you were here, many months ago, that when it comes to accessing Colorado River water, you can see where I'm going with this, California gets first dibs. And we're third. Who's second? And how do we get that place on the proverbial pole?
Sure. Well, it dates back to the 60s and earlier, the days of Carl Hayden and some amazing, amazing negotiations that occurred nationally and federally. At the end of the day, the congressional delegations were probably stronger, better positioned in California, definitely had the first allocation rights. Nevada has the second, Arizona being the third. But I often brag about that third place that we have because I think it made us immediately completely the best conservationists of water. And it made us know that we had so much more to lose. You don't see the types of water crises that you've seen in California, in Arizona. And part of that, I think, is because we knew of our positioning. We knew of our third tier positioning. We knew we had to be the better water managers. And despite some of the things you sometimes see in East Coast magazines and publications, Arizona is probably consumed of some of the best water managers in the entire country. We like to, you know, say that next to Israel and a few other places that are really cutting edge on water conservation, you know, if you want to learn how to do it, Arizona's the place.
You know, I moved here from California, California native, moved here almost 7 years ago now. And certainly growing up, the air quality was an issue we experienced every day, not just something that made news for legislative reasons and restrictions and taxes and, you know, emissions and things like that. And then, water was a big deal. And now, of course, we see a lot in the news around electricity in California. This question of the infrastructure to provide these essential public goods, at least in my view, is very important. Ron, can you speak a little bit to how Arizona has managed, you know, as Ben said, very effectively this scarce resource? And what are some of the players and issues in managing and delivering that?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So about 40% of Arizona's water demand comes from the Colorado River. And I think another important point to add to what Ben was saying is that while we did get third and it's made us better water managers, we did do pretty well from a water allocation perspective. So the percent of the Colorado River allocation that comes to Arizona based on the population that we had at that time, we actually, those water managers did pretty well in securing that for the benefit of our state. So most of that comes to central and southern Arizona through the CAP, and the Central Arizona Water Conservation District manages that. Then you have large in-state water supplies that come from like SRP, Salt River Project. Most people are familiar with that. And then people are surprised to learn about this sometimes, but there are very large, high-quality groundwater aquifers in Arizona that have formed over, you know, frankly, thousands of years. And depending on where you're located and the regulations that apply to that, which I'm sure we'll talk about more later today, you do have the right to access that groundwater and use it for a water supply as well.
You mean as an individual, not just as a private enterprise?
Both, really.
Yeah,
that's right. And so, obviously, when it comes down from the water supplies that I just talked about, then it's, you know, the infrastructure to take it from an intake, treat it, deliver it to the customers is those utilities that we talked about earlier, either private, municipal, or districts.
You know, I imagine most folks, myself included, don't spend a lot of time thinking about the question of where my water comes from. Out of the tap, at least. They may have preferences for bottled water, whole other separate issue that we should probably talk about at some point. But they turn on the tap, they flush the toilet, they take a shower, a bath, they do the thing, the irrigation, and not a lot of thought about where's this stuff come from. You know, there was a YouTube video many years ago that made a real impact called The Story of Stuff, and it really traced through, you know, from raw materials through manufacturing to delivery and retail and so on, kind of the story of our things. The story of water seems to me to be a very, very important thing for us to understand. We're collectively using it, and there's only a few people really shepherding upstream, as it were. These water innuendos are just going to not stop, I think.
They're just really flowing, aren't they?
They really are, right? Especially if you're wet behind the ears, as I am on the topic. So in any case, we got to stop. This is ridiculous. Okay. But can you give us, and you've been doing this, but can you really kind of try to make this concrete for folks and answer this simple but difficult question? Where does our water come from? 40% comes from the Colorado River. What else is in the mix? Groundwater aquifers. What do people need to know to understand when they turn the tap on, they're literally tapping into this resource? Where does it come from?
And I hope Ron and I can both tackle this, because the reason it's a complicated answer is exactly what you said, is it depends on where the source is. So I'll speak to my backyard, the CAP, but at the end of the day, we are a wholesaler of water. You don't receive your water directly from a CAP canal, correct? That water is kept at a quality, very high quality, but it's not yet potable. It's not yet drinkable water. And so we are the wholesaler to our customers, mainly to municipalities, industries, Native American communities, various other contracted users of that. And so if you are drinking Colorado River today, water, it's going to be blended with some other sources that Ron can also talk to you about. But when we deliver that to the municipality, plays a huge role then in water quality in terms of treating that water and then actually delivering it through their infrastructure. So CAP by no means constrains or regulates how a city handles that water, hands it over, but we are the wholesaler. We are the kind of the Costco, if you will, of the water use. But it's hard, especially from an elected government official standpoint, to strike that balance, because we want citizens to not necessarily be concerned that when they turn on the tap, that water's not going to come out. We don't want a society that has that concern. And yet we don't also want to have a society that takes that for granted. And so I think in all of our marketing, I think everything we push out, we really do struggle to strike that balance of conservation. I think in this day and age, it's much better to lean towards that conservationist standpoint and have you at least appreciate where that water's coming from, so you turn it off or maybe turn off the sprinklers when it's raining.
Ron, conservation is something that's on everybody's mind. We were chatting about this a little bit before going on the air. You mentioned that you've got a book that literally deals with how to tackle this question. Can you unpack some of those issues? Whose job is conservation, and what should they be thinking and doing about it?
Yeah, sure. Before I do that, I'm going to add a little bit something to what Ben was just saying. I always, with this conversation, start at the highest level, and I have a little bit of an optimistic view, which is we live on the blue planet. We live on the blue planet. And we've always been able to solve these challenges before. And the technology exists today to access every one of those drops of molecules and get it to where it is needed. Now, it becomes an economic and environmental discussion at that point.
I'm really glad you said that, by the way. I want to just jump in here for a second. Having spent a lot of time in Africa, where one of the things that makes headlines is famine, it's so important for people to understand that typically famine-struck areas, it's not that there's no food there. It's that access to markets and the distribution of resources has either been rigged by a government that is not interested in supporting its people or is being affected by war or conflict or something. So it's not necessarily only a question of, is there enough? It is a question of the economics, the markets, the players involved in access and control over those resources.
And that's actually is always the real issue, in my opinion. Yeah. You read headlines and people have concerns, and that's probably appropriate, because at least that gets them thinking about the issue. But ultimately, it comes down to economics and the way we live and the way that we use water. So back to your prior question. So as a utility, we were really formed to address the certainty of what we call water scarcity. And so again, that's another, you say those words and people don't respond favorably to it. But the fact is, it's a very simple concept. Over time, when you have diminishing supply, such as what we have in the Colorado River with 20 years of drought and climate change and what's that's causing locally and around the world, and you got an increasing demand, well, that at some point in time, those will intersect, and that's water scarcity. The debate is it next year, or is it 20 years from now, or is it 50 years from now? And we say, does it really matter? If you know it's coming, you have to do everything right from the beginning. And that's kind of the main principle of our utility company and the way we focus at it. So what does that mean at the ground level, what we do in our utilities? Well, as we build, and Phoenix has a lot of opportunity because we're a growth state, to put the infrastructure in place that allows us to really maximize conservation and maximize things like water recycling, which is taking treated effluent and using it for beneficial purposes. So for example, our biggest utility, we are the water and wastewater provider in the city of Maricopa in Pinal County, which long-term, and we can talk about this later as well, I'm sure, does have a water scarcity issue it needs to address. And we knew that. And so we reuse 97% of the wastewater generated in that city of 55,000 people today for immediate beneficial purposes, which offsets your need to use the other sources that we talked about. But beyond that, that's what the utility can really enforce and upfront and how they plan and implement infrastructure. We then go to the customer end and we say, hey, look, there's conservation programs out there, and we're big believers in that. Water, use it wisely, and each different city and provider has their own conservation program. But there's parts in between, which is to us is that water historically hasn't necessarily been properly priced. And this isn't a discussion about should water cost more. It's about how you send the appropriate price signals. It isn't Walmart or Costco where the more you buy, the cheaper it should be. It's not that concept. It's a finite resource. So the more you buy, actually the more you should pay. And it's not a novel concept anymore. Most providers have gone to what's called a inverted pyramid structure where there's tiers and the more you use, the more you pay. But we think it can be taken a lot farther. And that was kind of the basis of the book that we wrote on it. We have 7 tiers instead of the usual 3 or 4. We actually provide a rebate to our customers that use 90% on the average household usage or less in the form of a monthly discount to their consumable rate on their bill. So they're seeing an immediate economic benefit for actually participating in conservation. And then we provide them the data they need to be proactive. And we do that through what's called fixed network metering. And this thing, that's pretty common on the power side, but it's not yet taken off on the water side. The technology exists. We've deployed it. It's very reliable, very useful. And we take the meter reads that we read hourly from all of our customers in our service areas, and we give it back to the customers in a very useful program that they can log into and say, hey, here's what I've used today. Here's what I used yesterday. Here's what I used last year, this week. You get the point. But even then, people don't want to log in and look at that all the time. So this system is programmed to actually alert them when there's changes, anomalies in their usage, or we detect a leak or things like that. And so when you put it all together from zoning rules that are put in place through how utilities deploy the infrastructure, maximizing things like recycled water to proper price signals to leak alerts and everything in between, you really can, we call it demand destruction. You can really bring down demand. And because the certainty of water scarcity exists at some point, all those things should be being done today by all water providers, in our opinion.
You know, it really reminds me, as a culture anthropologist who pays close attention to human practices, that we are asking a lot of the general population without providing them a lot of information about it. I mean, this idea of this level of metering and this kind of feedback loop would be so empowering for somebody who cared about this, either cared about lowering the cost of their bill or cared about the environment and wanting to, you know, reduce their footprint or whatever it is they care about. They need information in order to do that. And the typical monthly water bill is a pretty coarse instrument for guiding decision-making. Not to mention the preventative thing. I mean, a few summers ago, we were away for a month. And the day before we got back, the neighbor called me and said, hey, you know, there's been water running down your driveway for a couple of weeks now. Are you guys gone? Why didn't you call me before? And, you know, we had an irrigation controller thing that had just cracked from the heat of the summer. And $1,100 of water had run down the gutter while we were gone. So having these kind of monitoring systems, you know, certainly seems aligned with the way things are going with smart home technology and the Internet of Things and the fact that we can control everything from apps on our phone now. Why wouldn't we have a kind of a dashboard for our human life? Seems to make a lot of sense to me. On the conservation side, so water scarcity, maybe that's a kind of a difficult word for some people, but it's also a reality. You are asking and inviting consumers, users to change their behavior, turn the water off when you brush your teeth, things of that nature. Who else needs to do a better job? I mean, obviously, it's not only the residential customers of the state utilities that are using water. How does water fit into the broader world of business and communities and golf courses and everything else that's using water here in the state of Arizona, Ben?
Sure. Well, you know, from our perspective, you know, for years now, we've been working towards the negotiations of the drought contingency plan, which is commonly referred to in the media as DCP. And that really is focused on those macro users. The DCP, although we want the knowledge of it and our efforts to influence the individual water user, that message and that negotiation is between, at the largest point, three different states. And then very immediately thereof, it's also part of us working with our cities and municipalities, industrial users, for them to keep more of their water allocation in Lake Mead. So you'll see bumper stickers that see protect Lake Mead, you know, keep Lake Mead filled. Our Lake Mead measurements at certain elevations are what trigger from the Colorado River allocation whether or not we will have actual cuts in water use or water allocations to Arizona. So we've had to ask our municipalities. So think of the municipality as an entity. We've had to ask other users to please keep some of your allocation that you have a right to keep that in Lake Mead intentionally. It's an intentionally created surplus that we keep into the lake. That prevents us from having to have long-term cuts and Colorado River shortages. So we've had to have incredible macro negotiations, not only with municipalities, but obviously with the states as a whole. So that is definitely an example of the larger picture that we've been negotiating, we've been working with to prevent shortages and to increase conservation.
Now, Ron, you got into this. This hasn't been your entire career trajectory. You joined Global Water in 2004. Is that right?
That's right.
Prior to that, you were working in construction. Can you describe a little bit your professional trajectory, kind of starting in early young adulthood, and how you ended up in the role that you're in today?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So I was actually born in Arizona. I'm an Arizona native, one of the few. Not a lot of us here.
Me as well. All right.
Great.
We got 2 out of 10. That's good.
So I was actually born and raised in Lake Havasu City. And yes, it's true, that's a fun place to grow up. It was great. But that's actually also the man-made reservoir on Colorado River behind Davis Dam at Parker, where the pumping stations that take Colorado River water and pump it and deliver it to Southern California and pump it as they head into CAP and bring it to Central and Southern Arizona. So I grew up on the river, on a lake. And then it's actually where I also started in this industry. As a teenager, I was working for a family friend's company who put in the underground pipes at residential houses and the septic systems and things like that. And I guess those combined experiences, I did realize fairly young, this water is going to be a fairly important thing. Maybe I can build a career in it. I wasn't that smart at the time. I'm not saying that. It was just kind of an idea at the time. So I went to NAU and I'm a lumberjack and got a degree in what's called construction management, where I can return to this industry and keep building. But now I was building large scale, heavy civil water and wastewater treatment plants around the state. And then it's like any industry, it's kind of a small industry once you're in it. And I was fortunate to know a few of the founders that started Global Water, and they asked me to jump from the construction side to the owner-operator side and oversee the utilities that that we were consolidating. And I'm happy they did, because it allowed me to really take that passion and everything I'd learned on the construction side and apply it to, the retail end of the business, the service provider.
You know, I don't think I've ever mentioned this, but back in 2002, I was living in Jordan in the Middle East. I was had finished a Fulbright and was kind of in transition. And I got a little freelance job on the side as an editor for one of the largest construction magnates in the country. And he was doing a PhD at some university in the UK on construction management. And he wanted a native English speaker with an academic background to edit his English. So he was doing all the research and writing, but he wanted me to clean up the text. So I have read about 400 pages of a doctoral thesis on construction management. I don't remember anything of it, by the way. It's a while ago now. But what I am struck by is the idea inherent in that interdisciplinary approach to projects, that there are efficiencies available when you put the right people, the right resources, the right planning in place. Has that informed your approach at Global Water, or is that something that you kind of relegate to the dustbin of history? That was a previous life. Is there crossover?
Well, there's certainly crossover. I mean, it's kind of some of the things I was talking about earlier. A lot of the real efficiency and conservation and sustainability decisions occur way up front in planning, and then through planning, permitting, and then construction of the infrastructure. Once that's all built and done, if you haven't done it right, it is economically prohibitive to go back and do it right.
Yeah.
And so that's definitely something that I learned that I've been able to apply here. But, you know, either it's a really long thesis like that. I have one slide on construction management that's very simple. And
I would much rather have edited one slide than 400 pages, but I got paid to do it. It was fine.
Well, the one slide works. So, but it's always just a balance of speed, cost, and quality.
Now,
that's it.
One quick follow-up question, though, when it comes to timelines, because when you refer to scarcity, you're talking about projecting a point in the future when demand and supply are crossing over and there becomes less available. Either it will get tougher to acquire water, it'll be more expensive to acquire it, there will be growing competition for the resource. So planning for that kind of a time frame is very different than planning a 6 or 18 month heavy construction project. How do you factor in that kind of long-term planning? What kind of experts do you even need to engage with to make sure that that plan is somehow connected to reality? That's much bigger, it seems to me anyway, as an outsider.
I mean, obviously there's a lot to it.
Who's involved? Who contributes?
But before talking about the who, I think the main point I like to make to that is the cheapest water you have is the water you have today. So that's how it kind of bridges the thoughts I've talked about. And when we talk about it, we're on the blue planet, and I do think we'll figure it out as a human population and continue to solve those challenges. But we are dealing with water scarcity today because we are dealing with increased competition and increased costs and everything that you just mentioned. So how do you bridge that? Well, in reality, is it just means that as you're planning cities for 100 plus years, you have to fundamentally understand that the water you have today is the cheapest water you will ever have. And so you need to stretch it and get as most out of it as possible so that you can continue to grow. And then ultimately those bigger costs that are bound to come in the future get spread out over a larger population and you can deal with it. You can deal with it over time. So what was the actual question before I got off to that kind of overarching comment?
Yeah, well, it's fascinating, these kind of projections, right? You need to base a lot of decision-making today on your projections for the future of this resource and the management of this resource. Right. How do you begin to even think about that? Who do you bring in to help kind of make those decisions? Who's involved and what's that process like?
Yeah, certainly. So who's involved? That was the question. So we, you know, ultimately, when we take on the responsibility, which is what we really do when we get, as a private utility, a monopoly service right established in a jurisdiction, and or if it's your municipality and you're planning for their entire MPA, municipal planning area, you have to be able to build a planning study that says what happens when this builds out over 100 or 200 years. And so you start with the city's planners, and you create a long-term demand projection, and then you work backwards with what you have available. And we use, obviously, very large consulting engineering firms out there are very good at this. We have a lot of in-house expertise that we hire. We do think these are core competencies for utilities, and to the extent they can, they should keep some of those individuals with those capabilities inside. And then we work with hydrologists, and we work with utility operations personnel. And you know, there's quite a bit to it. But we have a utility master plan from the onset for the entire planned service area. And unfortunately, not all private utilities have done that. And they do it more as a patchwork type of approach. And that's resulted in some of the negative things that are also making the headlines here in Metro Phoenix around some private utilities that have frankly given us a bad name. But it is important, not just from an economic and efficiency perspective, so cost of infrastructure, utilization of infrastructure, it is as important on the water resources side to really start from the full master plan and work backwards with those experts.
Yeah, Ben, I know you want to respond to that. And I also want to kind of put the ball right over into your court on this one, tee you up to respond. When you are dealing with the multiple constituencies, the working back and forth between municipalities, and I mean now with your attorney hat on, you're in conversation with constituents and citizens of particular places, as well as with developers, as well as with the city, as well as with the state. You know, the complexity of what Ron's talking about as it gets implemented in areas is quite fascinating to me. Thoughts on this matter?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that one of the factors, and Ron certainly mentioned individuals that are part of this. I'm going to use the broader term of one of the forms of language that works across all of those, as long as you can make it a common term, is science. And I know that that sounds very broad, but surprisingly, I'm 41. I didn't think we'd live in a day and age like we do now, where it seems like everywhere around the corner, science is under attack or scientific data is under attack. But we rely incredibly heavily on expertise, on hydrologists, on scientists. I'll give you an example of something that's resonated very well at all levels of the government and helped us communicate things like DCP, which is, Ron mentioned that we're in the midst of a 20-year drought. And the question is, well, is that a normal cycle? Is that something that's normal that will pan out? And you turn to an ASU tree ring study that was conducted that shows us that this is anomalous. This is not something we have seen before, maybe in 1,200 years. So I don't know about you, but I don't think I'm willing to wait 1,200 years to see if this is going to pan itself out. So we as people, as individuals, as humans in this state and planet, have to be proactive, and we have to find a way to communicate that. I'll be honest, in the water community, I'm incredibly, incredibly encouraged by not only the acceptance of science and scientific data, but the ability to take that around and communicate it to different groups. And we utilize that to do things like the drought contingency plan to help enable cities, states, and this country, in fact, to take the right steps to conserve water. So I just kind of had to make that plug for what seems obvious, but
well, it's an important point, especially in an era when the vitriol in the media and social media, and the silos of different consumption of ideologies is creating weird echo chambers about these things. Where I look to is not so much the rhetoric, which can be misleading, although fiery and entertaining at some level, or disconcerting even, but to the reality. Are you finding here at the state or municipal level an anti-science bent, as we have seen reported about some of our national organs that play a role here? Or are people more level-headed? They're trying to navigate through this thing. I mean, is that infecting? Listen, let me put this in context. America's always had, in our 200 plus year history, an anti-intellectualism that is as much native as anything else. So I'm not talking about that. Sure. But science has also played a role in steering decision-making. How does it look through the lens you have now at the state level and also at the municipal level?
Well, I would say that we have warning signs at the state level, maybe taking a step back from water in specific, but we have many warnings at the state level that there are some anti-science and maybe just wanting to push science aside, looking at scientific data that I'm concerned about. I will tell you, though, in the opposite, within the water community, within water leaders and the folks that I work with on a day-to-day basis, I don't think we can get enough science. And I think people basically base their decisions and studies. I mean, our meetings, a reverse water pun, this may seem dry, but we definitely look at an incredible amount of data and figures that tell us exactly where our water sources are leading and the kind of impacts that this drought will have. I often tell people who ask me what it's like to be in elected office right now, today. And also, obviously, being a candidate who ran in 2016 in the Trump-Hillary election, you know, what it's like to be in office right now. And I can tell you, and I often use this phrase, this position on the Central Arizona Project and the folks I get to work with, it's like taking a warm bath from partisan politics. I mean, we function together as a unit that is nonpartisan, that looks at water issues in a nonpartisan way. And I will tell you, and end with an encouraging comment, that when we have taken water issues to the legislature and the governor, we have seen that same cleansing of partisan issues, at least on the issue of water. And that must continue.
I'm going to ask you a little bit about your backstory, but Ron, I wonder if there's anything you wanted to respond to and what Ben was speaking to there.
Yeah, so I'll give an example of that I think answers that. So in Pinal County, again, Pinal County is going through an interesting time on the waterfront. Not going to spend a lot of time right now unless you want it later in the discussion, but because of the challenges that Pinal County is facing as a group, the major stakeholders in Pinal County have gotten together and have started what's called a basin study. And so it's less partisan than it is. There's a bunch of people with different interests that have now gotten Correct. Together and said, look, we don't have a choice anymore. I was talking earlier about how we look at our specific utility service areas and this, how municipalities look at theirs. Well, even that doesn't work because you've all got your straws in the same bathtub. And so why obviously there's people that look at it from a state level in Pinal County, other than what ADWR has done, there really hasn't been an organization that looked at it from a what they call a sub-basin-wide perspective. So the entire groundwater aquifer that's under the active management area down there. So I happen to be on a board of a group called Pinal Partnership, which is really just an entity that exists to combine government with private interests and non-for-profit and Native American communities and say, hey, look, for issues that matter to Pinal County, like water and transportation and schools and education, things like that, we're going to work together. And so under that banner, we went through a federal grant program with the Bureau of Reclamation and secured a $1.36 million funding. I call it a grant because it's simple. It's not exactly a grant, but people understand what that is, to get all those interests together and execute a three-year study, which is really focused back on, again, the science of this. We're not just going to rely on the information that has existed in the past, just rely solely on ADWR. ADWR, people think it's their job as their regulator to solve the problems. It's not. Their problem is to regulate. and it's really up to the stakeholders to solve the problems. And so we're going to take a fresh look, use all of these interests working together to rebuild a groundwater model for the Pinal AMA, to look at it under things like climate change and different growth projections, and then in the end have some actual adaptation and mitigation strategies that come out of the end of it. And we're only a year into that three-year process, and it's going well. And I just think it's an example of ultimately we don't have a choice when it comes to water. We have to move on from partisan and even individual interests because that's the only way that we can get to real long-term solutions that'll help us get through the challenges today. And I see a lot of that going on, and unfortunately sometimes it takes a crisis for that to happen, and I don't throw the crisis word around because I don't think we're actually in a crisis from a state or a Pinal County perspective. Other people are saying that. The facts prove differently. It's certainly not a crisis, but it is a challenge, and those are two different things, and we need to be working together more on those challenges, and I do think that is occurring as much now as I've seen in my 20 years in the industry.
Yeah, you know, it's well known, at least in the world of marketing, that it's harder to sell prevention than a cure. When someone's in acute pain, it's very easy to sell them a headache medicine, but selling them wellness, preventative approaches, lifestyle changes is difficult. And when what we're selling here is good citizenship and conscious participation in the sharing of resources that are limited. You know, there's plenty of folks out there for whom that they just have their heads in the proverbial sand. They don't. This isn't going to happen in my lifetime. I don't care. And you know, OK Boomer has emerged as a clapback to that kind of thinking. Ben, you have an interesting personal story as well. I was fascinated to learn that Ron grew up on Lake Havasu City, and kind of that whole world really unpacks a lot of that unique perspective he brings. You're also an Arizona native, and you have found your way to the kind of law you practice and to your role on the water issues through your own trajectory. Can you explain a little bit about your background and how you ended up here?
Yeah, absolutely. I born and raised in Arizona, and didn't go much farther than Tucson for schooling, so University of Arizona for undergrad and law school. But very quickly learned, even you know, as a young adult, of my sustained passion for the state. I'll admit, I think when I was younger, I just couldn't wait to get out of here. I thought, I'm going to go to a big city. I'm going to live in New York or Chicago. But you know, those ideas kind of shed once you realize just what an amazing place Arizona is. And also just how young we are. We are truly a young state, whether you're looking at the issues of land development, proper zoning, bringing density into downtowns, making walkable environments. These are things that other cities figured out in some cases over a century ago. And we are just now taking the steps. We just had our first downtown grocery store in the city of Phoenix open up. I mean, think about how, you know, amazing that is for us, and just completely mundane information for a large city that's had grocery stores in their downtown area forever, right? But yet it's exciting for us, and that's why it's exciting to be here, you know, at this kind of day and age. And as I moved forward and started practicing law and finding an area that really blended politics and the practice of law and consensus building, I very frequently joke that I'm an attorney that's never sued anyone and never will. I mean, my job is a consensus builder with communities and cities and developers to do the best thing for what that area needs. And so it was a natural evolution, and kind of to feed the bug that I always had to be in public service and run for office, it was a natural evolution for me to look toward water and to look for an elected position. That while, you know, most people hearing this don't even realize that the CAP has an elected board, it's not a sexy, you know, position that gets you on the cover of Time magazine, but it is a position that I think is making waves, there you go, and is making a big difference for Arizona and for the future. So I love where I'm at. I love the access I have to folks, to elected officials, to you know, water professionals like Ron and leaders in the industry that are going to make a difference in, frankly, a very unique arid desert.
One of the things I was fascinated by in our conversation a few months ago about commercial real estate and zoning was the degree to which you have to deal with the microcosm of things, a specific piece of land, a specific corner, a specific community, and all the things that intersect there. So it's one thing to have a theory of this stuff. It's one thing to have looked at the history of it at a high level. It's quite another to execute on consensus building in this specific place and time. You mentioned the downtown grocery store, which brings in the development side of this story. There has to be a level of population growth that will sustain the existence of a store before the store can happen. So there's sort of, you know, it's a chicken and the egg thing. When it comes to water, obviously we are fastest growing everything, you know, all the superlatives about Arizona, about population influx, about, you know, development, all the different metrics are striking in the speed of our growth. Water is a critical part of that. Can you give us an example, as you did previously, kind of to connect this to what it looks like in reality, a specific place and time where some of these issues are being hashed out? Because one of the things about the law, as well as about public utilities and private utilities, is you've got to deal with these things in the world people actually live in. And that varies a lot depending on place and location and demographics and all kinds of stuff. So can you give us an example of how water plays into development?
Absolutely.
I'm reaching here because this is so foreign to me, but I'm curious.
No, I've got a solid example. So Chandler has done an amazing job making itself a mecca for tech and companies like Intel. And I've personally been involved in some cases, not specifically for Intel, but for other data centers. These large areas that are either holding or keeping data or producing things such as an Intel with microchips. And the reality is that we did a study through ASU that showed just the economic impact that the CAP's allocation of water has had on Arizona. And it, in relatively short period of time, it was over, you know, $3 billion in economic impact. And that's because water touches literally everything. So you take something like a tech industry in Chandler and you look at the beginning of why did they come to Arizona? And if you look at an Intel, a lot of people don't realize that one of the biggest things that goes on inside of an Intel is the cleaning of the microchips, the cleaning of the actual technology. And what does that require? It requires water. And in fact, it requires a very special water that they call pure H2O. It's kind of nerdy, but they actually void it of any minerals or anything other than oxygen and hydrogen combined to create water. That industry would have never come to Arizona, let alone Chandler, if there's any question about our water resource and our water reliability. So when you look at the headline of whether or not Arizona has a sustained amount of water, it's not just about turning on the faucets. It's about turning on economic development and attracting the next big Intel. Because if and when that ever came into question, we stop attracting those users. And then on the flip side, from the neighborhood perspective, when you bring in something like an Intel or a tech user or a heavy water user, neighborhood groups and other groups have an interest in saying, is this the right land use for Arizona, for a desert? And so these are the conversations that we are constantly kind of melding together. That's just one example, but you know, obviously the other big one is just home building in general. Just the expansion of home building, whether it's sprawl into further areas or whether it's infill. And that not only has a water use quotient, but also an infrastructure cost of development. It's much more expensive to build new infrastructure to take water far west or far north or far east than it is for me to redevelop a patch of undeveloped or redeveloped land in the center of downtown Phoenix. It has the infrastructure. Now we just need the water.
Is the infrastructure for infill sufficient? I mean, obviously, yes, it's a lower cost to develop that lot in between things, but and I'm supportive of those trends. But is the underground or wherever it is infrastructure necessary? You know, Ron mentioned earlier how expensive it is to come back and redo stuff later. So when you're developing that kind of project, how does water as well as other resources play into the consideration?
Usually, yes. I mean, usually the underground infrastructure in terms of bringing the actual water, the physical water piping to the area, usually that is sufficient, or for that specific development, the costs are expected or at least appropriate for that. Interestingly, sometimes we run into water pressure issues. If you're talking about high rise or larger buildings, that can be a more expensive infrastructure issue as well. And then the good thing is, especially if you're doing a new build or even a rehab. The other issue, of course, of water infrastructure are the actual hardware and water conserving mechanisms like faucets or shower heads or things like that that we
toilets
have. Toilets, right. Low flow type mentalities. But every chance we have an opportunity to fix infrastructure or update it, it is expensive, but it's essential. I mean, one of the most horrendous stats across the country is just how much water, and I'm not picking on you and your vacation and your pipe that broke, but how much water is lost, not just in accidents, but in ongoing infrastructure issues, literal, just day-to-day leaks. Phoenix, and when I say Phoenix now, I'm being more general, Tempe, Chandler, you know, Scottsdale, Mesa. We as a whole have a very low loss of water through infrastructure leaks, but we have older cities in the country. So we have generally around 4-5% infrastructure loss. You have cities, older areas that are losing upwards of 20% of their water supply to leaks as it flows to your faucet. And so those are some of the things that are just really scary in terms of water scarcity and loss.
Ron Fleming, you're also on the board of directors of the Maricopa Economic Development Alliance. So you're in conversations with a lot of different stakeholders. What beyond, including water, but what else are people trying to factor in as we take growth as a goal and as the reality? What are folks concerned about? What are they paying attention to? Is water, where does water sit in the hierarchy of needs, as it were?
Sure, yeah. I mean, look, obviously, overall cost of living, education is a big one for not just the talent pool that they can access, but for the schools that they can send their employees' kids to is very important, we find. But I will tell you that water has been going up on that list for quite some time, and I would say it's getting near the top. Nationally, executives are becoming more aware of this issue. Now, that's a good and bad to that, as there is with most things, but I couldn't agree more with what Min was saying. You know, water is economic development. I mean, they're just linked from both an availability perspective and a cost perspective and an infrastructure capacity perspective. And so, look, I mean, I will go ahead and take this opportunity because I think it is a great example to spend a little bit more time on what's going on in Pinal County. And it's not just because we as a company have a lot of service area there, so we've got a lot of interest there, so I'm very involved, but it's also probably an indication of a certain type of challenge that's starting to grow throughout the state. And that's continued growth through what's called the Assured Water Supply Program. So in Arizona, part of the 1980 Groundwater Management Act and the regulations that have been put in place then and since then, for people to build homes and businesses under varying criteria, you do have to demonstrate an assured water supply, a 100-year assured water supply, which can be a combination of a lot of things. But if you cannot issue those in what's called the active management areas, which basically covers all of Metro Phoenix, most of the municipalities in Pinal County, down into the Tucson, Santa Cruz area, there's one up in Prescott. If you can't demonstrate that, then you can't get that piece of paper from the Arizona Department of Water Resources, and you cannot construct. And really, for the first time in the history of our state, I think I'm maybe not an expert on everything that's happened in the state, but the first time I can recall, there's places that where they're not issuing those assured water supplies anymore. So this isn't a future conversation anymore. It's happening today. Now, I think the reality is still not matching the headlines on that issue. The reality is, and this you talked about an example of tying reality to perspective or perceptions, and also I think the third way to look at it is regulatory, because regulatory is just a different way of looking at all these things, is the reason they're not issuing a few assured water supplies in Pinal County or in the Pinal AMA is a regulatory system and a regulatory construct that says they can't demonstrate that 100-year assured water supply. However, if you step back from that, the important point is there are already issued like guaranteed certificates and what's called designations of assured water supply. I don't mean to get too detailed, but it's an important point, to serve 5 times the municipal industrial population in Pinal County. So I always say, picture this. Can you picture 5 times the cities that exist in Pinal? That's already approved today. That's a long-term growth. However, over 100 years, which is what the regulatory construct requires ADWR to regulate to, it does show that there's like a 10% deficit to the total wants, not what exists today, not the 5 times I talked about, but everybody that's placed a want, which is called an analysis of assured water supply inside of that AMA, they calculate it as if that's 100% being used today in the ADWR groundwater model. And they show that ultimately there's a 10% shortage. And so that's the headline that's come out recently. That's the headline potentially can spread, I think, ultimately to other parts of the state, which is very bad from an economic development perspective and attracting the types of businesses that Ben was talking about. So there is those challenges that we got to work through. But as we work through them, we also got to do better about reflecting reality correctly inside of the headlines and the things that are written about it.
Let me just ask a few clarifying questions, because I think what you were saying is important, and I want to make sure its implications are clear, at least as far as your position on the issues. So you're saying that the regulatory mechanisms are using the correct metric, or that needs to change?
So I think the rules were put in place the way they are for a good reason. I will say that. And the reason is they are trying to ultimately protect against an overallocation of water supplies that can create large challenges in the future. So the point is fair. However, in the details, I don't think that today, including all wants in a sub-basin, so we'll keep talking about Pinal because that's what we're talking about, my example was, that model includes all wants, all existing demands, all committed demands. Agricultural, which is obviously quite significant in Pinal, and it's another topic we could talk about here. I definitely always make the point we're not anti-ag. I think they're an important part of the state, important part of the community, and they need to be part of the solution as we're moving forward. There's no doubt. But in Pinal, they're 80% of the demand in EDWR's model, and the model basically shows that for the most part, they're going to keep farming the way they always have.
So in other words, it's not
for 100 years, and that's probably doesn't represent reality.
Yeah, there's a lot of technological innovation that is happening that would change some of the baseline assumptions.
There's no doubt. It's just over 100 years, growth's going to occur. Economies are going to change. Pricing, as the groundwater declines, will probably have an impact on what can be farmed and how much water is used to farm it. There's obviously always advances on the municipal and industrial side. And so we're sitting here where we have a challenge where a few assured water supplies aren't being issued. Although today, there is a 5 times overcapacity scientifically proven, but it's stopping growth today because of, in our opinion, an inaccurate projection of what the next 100 years are going to look like. Now, to their defense, nobody knows what the next 100 years, so they're being conservative. That's probably their job as regulators. I'm not here to 100% disagree with some of those. It's just when you get to the point that it's having real economic development implications and negative implications for communities, then you have to be willing to relook at those things and take a logical, more step-by-step approach than just saying, we don't have enough water, which is what the headlines made, because that is not reality.
Something that occurs to me, I need to ask both of you for my own curiosity as well as for informing the public on these issues. Are there international stakeholders that are involved in Arizona's water? And how does that play out? Canada, Saudi Arabia, any of the things that we might have heard about?
Sure. Yeah, sure. There's stakeholders just by, you know, it comes down to just basic private property rights, which is we have local farm owners in Arizona. La Paz County is a good example, where local farm owners have sold their farm, have sold the farm to outside interests, outside countries, owners from across the seas.
Australia was one I meant to mention.
Yeah, a lot of the Middle Eastern countries. There is, and let me be clear, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. No. That is the sale of property. People get a little up in arms when they hear about a Middle Eastern company buying property in Arizona. I don't get that. That in and of itself is a normal transaction. The concern is, And this is where I will get a little concerned. The concern is, what is that company doing with the land, and what were they doing with it in Saudi Arabia, and why are they coming here? And the quick, you know, discussion with that is, in a lot of countries, there are not the same groundwater protection laws and groundwater protection policies, and that has led to literally land in some countries subsiding, concaving from the lack of geological water existence and pressure, and also water getting down to the point where it might still be there, but they don't have the technology, or it's just not financially feasible to reach that water, to the point where it's cheaper to purchase land in the United States to continue to grow, for example, alfalfa to make hay to feed dairy farms back in Saudi Arabia. So the question isn't who are the players and whether it's okay to sell to, you know, to foreign nationals or to sell to foreign companies. That's of course a normal transaction. It's the issue of the inherent land use itself and the types of farming products and the high end or high use of water. And so, yeah, I think international plays huge. The other international implication too is just the partnerships we have in terms of research and technology. And I've been to multiple conferences where we are sitting right there with some of the lead desalinization scientists from Israel, and we're all comparing notes and we're, you know, discussing what they're doing there and how we can do that here and what the future of desal is and other technology. These are the types of partnerships that will continue to lead to conservation and better use of water. But it's a global issue. We talk about the blue planet, and I'm not countering you, Ron, but I think the figure though is it's a blue planet, but there's less than, I think, 5% of that's drinkable water. Right. And so it starts to get a little bit more real when you look at what that truly means, especially with where desal is today.
Yeah. And I think what you were speaking to is the optimism that says one thing we know about humans is we solve problems and we're going to figure this one out. But it's going to take the kind of partnerships and shared engagement around a set of agreed upon facts. You know, the old saying of it's not even that old, that you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. We really do need to understand the realities of all this. And I agree with you, Ben. I don't think international ownership of things is an issue. That's, in fact, an acknowledgement of how interconnected we are in many ways, and it's certainly something that has, you know, several hundred year history around the world. It's not like, you know, we invented the multinational corporation yesterday. But then the question comes, do local communities feel that those who may impact, you know, we can't go down this rabbit hole because of time and probably other things, but you know, the way that Nestle owns water supplies in communities that have very limited access to clean water is one very striking example that I'm sure is nuanced and has many points of view about where private ownership of natural resources can have a positive or negative impact in communities. As we wrap up our conversation today, this is a fascinating subject, nerdy though some aspects of it may be. I mean, it really does touch everyone who drinks water and brushes their teeth, takes showers, eats food that's grown in the ground. I mean, it's who has a body comprised of whatever percentage, 85% water, whatever. Are the issues in the media the right ones, or is there something else that we should all be paying attention to? Ron?
It's just a balance because, you know, some audiences, you know, like the negative headlines, or I don't say they like it, but I mean, that's what they focus on.
It sells the product.
Some are too optimistic. I think with almost anything, the realities in between and understanding those facts is what's important. So I do think that, you know, the focus on the Colorado River and the multi-state agreement through DCP and now wherever that goes from there, it's the right focus. Now, relooking at, even though it's been held for decades, is probably the best groundwater regulation system in the country, which we appropriately give a lot of credit to the leaders that had the foresight at that time and put the Groundwater Management Act in place. It is 40 years later, and should we... Should we be willing to look at some of those things and say does it fit with what we need or is appropriate today? So looking at really relooking at all the AMAs and how those are impacted today based on today's facts is appropriate to be looking at. I do just think that over time and again not to counter Ben's point, I just think that that. There's entire parts of the world that depend fully on desalination, Middle East, Singapore, et cetera. And they did it because they had to. There's a story about Australia when their Colorado River ran dry, you know, geez, upwards of 20 years ago now, or I guess 15 years ago now. As a country, they went out and spent $8 billion on desalination plants. Now they got a coastline on all sides and they can do that. I realize Arizona doesn't have that today, but they spent $6 to $8 billion, I believe is the number, on desalination plants. And then guess what? The economics of what that cost people caused human behavior to change and people stopped wasting water and washing their driveways with water and everything else. And demand significantly dropped. And then it rained again, and their Colorado River started running again, and they shut off those desalination plants. I think one of them's operational today. And we've got to be focused on not letting the pendulum swing like that, right? It's constant improvements to the programs we have, constant improvements to the raw laws on the river, which is what DCP is, and as it keeps going. Just moving it forward versus waiting for a crisis, swinging really hard the other direction. Things change, it swings back. And so, again, I think we as a state have done well in that in the past, and I hope we can continue to do that with the challenges we're facing right now.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ron Fleming, President and Chief Executive Officer of Global Water Resources. Appreciate that perspective. Ben, I know that civic participation in our democratic processes is something you're deeply passionate about and touches many aspects of your work. And of course, people's ability to participate and make informed decisions relies on the information and the storytelling that they're consuming. Is the media focused on the right stuff when it comes to water? Is there other issues we should also be talking about?
You know, I think locally I've been very proud of our media and how it covers, for the most part, water issues, and especially through the state of Arizona. California is notorious for having, you know, no offense to your home state, but for having these headlines as of late that say drought's over, you know, all's good. And again, we're in the middle of a constant 20-year drought. And I think Arizona's done a very good job and the media's done a good job of basically reporting that accurately. I think nationally is my biggest concern, and it comes down to an economic development concern for the state of Arizona. Look, the drought contingency plan by definition is designed to take the right water cuts at the right time. So let me be clear. It's not designed to prevent or avoid water cuts. It's to take the right cuts at the right time. And that makes us amazing stewards of our water supply. My concern is that when we do have that first cut under DCP, and hopefully not future, but that first cut, that the, you know, East Coast Magazine reads, Arizona's water supply dwindling, Arizona's out of water because we did the right thing. I mean, you know, let's use a silly example. I mean, Dr. McIntyre, let's say you could buy a brand new car, but you don't. You buy a used car, okay? And the headline the next day, because for some reason, Arizona Public's fascinated with your car purchase, you know, powers, you know, says, oh, what a cheapo, he bought a used car. And that's the story of the day. Well, what's the backstory? The backstory is you've got two kids that you're saving up to go to college. You're about to buy a bigger, better house for your family. So you bought the used car to do the right thing. And the headline should be best dad ever, right? That's the backstory. The backstory is, why are we taking the cuts that we're doing in the long-term stewardship? And I don't think national media at this point in time is doing a good job getting the backstory and the true intent of what we're trying to do.
Well, I appreciate that perspective very much, and it just reminds all of us that our job is to pay attention, to get informed, to question the source, both the source of our water and the source of our information. Ben Graff, Arizona land use and zoning attorney with extensive experience in government and public and private projects, thank you very much for sharing your perspective with us today. When are you up for re-election again?
It's 2022. For some reason, it's us and U.S. senators that get six-year terms, and everybody else has, you know, very short two-year terms or four-year terms. So
I know there's another election that's going to consume our attention between now and then, but if you choose to run again, I wish you the best. It seems you're bringing a sense of perspective that is needed to this kind of work. For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre. We'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.